League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Welcome to the Dear Lovejoy podcast special. Woo-hoo. And it is really special today. We've got both Mark and Fina here today.
Hello.
Hi.
Because I'm having a conversation with Tom Davis, but we're recording this one live. We're actually streaming it live. We've actually done it. We've streamed it live on Twitter.
It went out. And if you weren't there, you missed out on one of the, you know, when JFK, the Apollo missions, you've missed out.
It was
out
one of those, was it?
It was. People will ask you, your kids will say, where were you?
It was a bit of a rush to get it done.
Just a bit.
Tom had to get to the dentist. But so it was good though. It was exciting. We're filming it and we don't really know what we're doing with it, but we're going to start filming these, I think, and put them on a YouTube channel somewhere. Is that a good idea?
I think so. I like we've continued the tradition of not knowing what the hell we're doing. Well, when we first started the podcast, we didn't know how to do it. We learned how to do it. And I think we've continued this. I mean, lucky we've got Fina here. She's sort of quite a sensible head.
Yeah. Well, my secret is make it up as you go along.
So. I'm not sure your mic's in there. I can't hear you.
Can you not?
No.
Oh, no.
What did you say?
Wow. Oh,
there you go.
Nice.
Yeah. The sensible head of Fina forgot to turn her mic up. There you go. Oh, dear.
Whoops.
Oh, dear. So anyway, it is good. We did film it. And if you are listening to this, we haven't got a YouTube channel up and running at the moment, but Mark will put it in the description of it if we've got the YouTube channel up, where to go to. And hopefully we'll have that done. So fingers crossed on that. Anyway, this is exciting. It was a good interview anyway, wasn't it, with Tom?
It was great. He went further than I thought he would do with personal kind of feeling type stuff.
And he has
really good.
And he has an interesting look on the industry as well. So I hope you enjoy this. Anyway, here's Tom Davis.
This is just a guide to modern life. Modern life is hard to get just right. It can frustrate you and annoy. And if it does, right into Dear Lovejoy.
Welcome to the Dear Lovejoy podcast, and it's a special today. Special guest is Tom Davis. Tom, thank you very much for joining me in my kitchen.
Thank you for having me in your kitchen, your real kitchen.
This is my real kitchen, yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah, because you've been in the Sunday brunch kitchen, of course, but not this one. And we're trying to record this live. We don't know if it's working or not, but we're actually filming it, but we don't know whether it's going to go out live on Twitter or not.
It's quite a nice attention of not knowing at any point this could cut into a live broadcast. And everyone's just going to go, no, now you're live.
Now you're live.
It's literally walking on an eggshell, how much I can swear and what I can say.
Be careful what you say. You can swear, Tom. As every guest who comes on, I bought you a present. This is a bottle of red wine. Do you like red wine?
I love red wine, yeah.
Cool. Well, it's a nice one, apparently.
I was told as a youngster never to open a gift in front of someone.
Oh. Go on.
I mean, I'll do it this once.
But do you know...
I've never done it before.
Do you know anything about...
I'm not a connoisseur.
No. Do you know what? It's a nice
bottle. Drop.
Yeah, yeah. Because the guy down the shop always... Every now and then I interview people who know a bit about wine and they always go, yeah, that's a lovely drop of wine or something.
It's 2012. Great year.
Is it? For what? Not wine.
That's the thing that people say, isn't it? Wow. How deep does the bottom go? Is that not the thing?
Goes all the way up, right?
It goes all the way up. My fingers coming out the top.
Did you drink a lot when you were younger? You don't drink that much now, do you?
No, I'm not a big drinker now. I used to, yeah. All my 20s was a pretty heavy sort of 10 years of boozing. I can't handle it now.
But you were a scaffolder.
Yeah.
Did you? Because it always amazes me when I hear about roofers and scaffolders, because they go out drinking and then they get up the next day and do that job.
Yeah,
it's pretty tough to do that job hungover.
Yeah, I mean, when I first started, I'm sort of exaggerating slightly, but I do remember a time when people used to be on the scaffold and they'd have Stellas at either side, and they'd be drinking as they started. I mean, I'm talking about a long time ago, and that was sort of folklore, really. The sort of booziness of these guys. And then health and safety came in and it was, you know, obviously you couldn't drink on the scaffold anymore, but or when you were on a building site. But certainly the sort of the guys generations before me, it was all about boozing, and there was a sort of a lifestyle which very much was, you know, you're up sort of 7 a.m. you're starting work, and then you're straight in the pub at 3-4 p.m, and you're doing that 5 times a week, 6 times a week.
Did you ever fall off?
I did. I had a, yeah, I did fall off one winter. It had been snowing, and so basically, people. I mean, this is some very technological scaffolding talk.
Do it. All the listeners who are into scaffolding love this bit.
Oh, this is the stuff. Don't talk about any of your TV or film work,
show
mate.
Is nonsense.
Yeah. We want to hear some building stories. Someone had moved what they call a transom, which is the like the tube that goes across there, and it basically there's a gap that you could fall through. And so a painter had moved it, and he hadn't put it back. So it becomes a trap, like a booby trap. And as I was walking along chatting to a mate, I just went right through the floor, and I went smashing through about 3 floors of, yeah, busted my ribs. But it just actually weirdly just meant I was in the pub for even longer time. you sort of look for those little moments.
You were at the RTS Awards this week.
Yeah.
You were up against Love Island. Ant and Dec Saturday Night Takeaway. I don't know the results. What
Love
happened?
Island won, yeah.
How'd you feel about that?
You know what? It's nice to be nominated for. When you make something like Murder and Successful, it's such a show that's so close to my heart, and it's been such a massive show for me. But I never made it with any anticipation that it would ever take off like it has,
yeah,
and be the thing it has. So to be nominated, especially by the RTS for those awards, is pretty phenomenal. It's pretty amazing. But it's a tough thing, because I played sport at a young age, and that out of nowhere you have a competitiveness that you wouldn't have ever had in scaffolding, or you wouldn't have ever had in most other jobs. So all of a sudden you don't ever think about winning anything. I never write anything or make anything going, oh, this will win awards. But all of a sudden you're sitting in a room with loads of people who are up for,
yeah,
you know, and you suddenly realise, you know, when you watch the Oscars and you take the mick out of people going,
yeah,
it's really hard when you, like, the moment you realise you haven't won is, and that's nothing against anyone who has, but it's kind of soul crushing.
I've been up for a few awards, but I've never really cared that much about losing. The most interesting one are the radio ones, though. I always say awards are a win-win. There's some bloke who's laughing all the way to the banks. You've all had to pay to enter.
That's a crazy thing.
You pay to enter, you pay to sit down and have
a
drink.
You pay for a table.
Yeah, you pay for everything. So there's someone, but then if you get an award, it helps your brand. So it's a win for you. If you get a nomination, it's a win. Everyone wins. That's why awards are great. But radio is, when you get involved in the Sony Awards, when you turn up there, people who don't win are devastated, because they've got this really antiquated radar system thing where people are still writing notes in notebooks and stuff. Everyone's scared of losing their job. You get a Sony, you're guaranteed to keep your job for another year. You know? And maybe you've got a little way of getting a pay rise.
Yeah.
So they're devastated. People in those on the radio ones, it's just unbelievable watching that.
I think because we were nominated for two, so I was nominated because the show was nominated and I was nominated. And genuinely in my life, that's the first time I've ever been nominated or had the chance of winning anything as an individual.
Like, did you go up against on that one?
Charlie and Daisy Cooper from This Country, which is brilliant, and Michaela Cole from Chewing Gum. So it's a really, and you know, and when you break it down, it's a category which is pretty much everyone who's performed in comedy over the last year. So to be in those last three is pretty incredible. But there's a part of you that's just sort of, you still, when you're sitting there, you're like, oh mate, I never dreamt of even I didn't even know I'd been put forward. So you're kind of like sitting there and you're like, oh wow, this is fucking crazy.
And your job's harder than the others because your lines aren't written for you, which we'll talk about. You said you did sport. What sport did you do?
I played football for a bit.
Were you up front or at the back?
At the back. I wasn't.
You must have been dominated. You must have been brilliant.
You know what? I was deceptively quick when I was younger, but I was never a naturally gifted footballer, but I was like a brick wall. There wasn't much chance of getting around me.
Did you have trials?
Nah, never at that level. I had that weird thing of like, I was talking to someone about this the other day, because I've gone back to doing stand-up, and you start going back through stories and you start chatting to people you might not have talked to that much before, because I always believe, you know, the characters that I love talking about are the people that I grew up with.
Yeah.
And I saw a guy that I used to play football with, and it was a low level. It was like we were 13 playing in sort of like a one of those sort of kids' cup things. And he was like, do you remember that game and that goal I scored?
Yeah.
We're 13. The ball came out. You cleared a header. Someone flicked it on. I chested it down and I volleyed it and went in the top corner. It was the best moment of my life. And I thought, we're fucking 38. You peaked too fast.
I hate talking about your height because it's so obvious. And when I was just looking you up on the internet a couple of days ago, everything's about your height. Isn't it? But at your height, 6'7", 6'8", what are you?
6'7", yeah.
6'7". You know, you've got such an advantage over everyone else. I always say, if you give me another couple of inches, I'd have probably played for AC Milan in the 18.
but I've tipped the scale too far, Tim. There's a perfect time. And people go, yeah, what is the perfect height? And I think 6'4", I was really happy. And then I grew that little bit too much. Yeah. 6'7" is, it's a thing where I still have a weird thing of doing this for a job, which is the best thing that's ever happened to me. But before I even did this for a job, people would stop me in the street for pictures because I was tall. There'd be tourists.
Well, like, just stopping you for...
Just because you basically almost like a freak show. Like, people would just come up and go... So, and it still sort of happens. So you sometimes don't know if people... I've been at events where someone's gone, oh, is it right we get a picture? And you go, oh, yeah, cool, of course, of course. Well, I've never seen anyone as tall as you. What is it you do? And then you realise your career means nothing. They're just there. They just want a picture with a tall guy. And I always wonder what people do with that picture.
Yeah.
If they're going through that's so-and-so, that's so. Oh, look. That's
a tall bloke.
That's a tall guy that we met. I don't know what he does.
You did choose the wrong sport, though, because most sports, height matters. Yeah. Golf now matters. They're all tall now. Tennis. Yeah. Snooker, obviously, because you can lean on the table further, not use the rest. Swimming, you get to rugby. the other end quicker. Rugby, yeah. But football, the best player in the world's tiny, Messi.
Yeah.
So it's weird. So
I'd say that Peter Crouch.
Good feet for a tall man. That's what they always say.
Good feet for a tall man. But yeah, I mean, boxing or anything else could have. Wrestling, MMA, it all should have,
Or comedy.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, I just thought, everything else feels like a lot of hard work, and I'm halfway there by looking stupid. So I can just
make the most. Getting back to the RTS, do you like show business? Because I have this problem with these award ceremonies. Simon Rimmer, you know, my
co-presenter,
he absolutely loves it. He loves turning up to those things. I absolutely hate it. I love the people there, but I can't be bothered with the small talk. You look nice today. Oh, what are you up for? Or do you think you're going to win? Or what are you up to at the moment? It's just so banal and boring. And he goes, it's brilliant. We argue all the time about it.
I'm sort of with you, actually. I like the people. I like seeing people that you know, like there's people there that I see that I haven't seen for 4 or 5 years. One reason, because it's a funny job, this one. You can end up working really closely with a producer or a commissioner, but and they move on, or you go to another check, whatever. It's nice to catch up, but the showbiz side of it is not something I'm particularly keen on. I sort of think that in the last few years, everything's got sort of a little bit mixed up with like reality TV and fame. And when I first started this, my thing was to make something. I always thought, yeah, they're sort of dead and gone away, but DVDs, like, to have something, a product that you've worked really hard at and you believed in, that's all I ever really wanted to do, to make a bit of a show that I believed in, that I thought, wow, that's, I've done that, and I can sort of always have that. No matter what, if I end up back on a building site, I've made something. So, but fame is a really sort of, it's a horrible and dangerous and nasty thing, and I always think, like, as silly as it sounds, when we were kids, and me and you were younger guys, like Gladiators was a massive TV show, right? And that was like the big Saturday night show. To get on Gladiators, you had to be at the top of your physical condition. You had to try to beat someone and you had to win at something. And it was like all about, if you were young watching it at home, you go, oh, wait, I'd love to fucking do that. I'd love to like get that fit and be on TV. And everything, you kind of need a bit of that. And then sort of reality TV came along and people would be like Joey Essex or whoever would turn around and say, I thought Africa was in Europe. And then he has a Rolex and he drives the best car and everyone goes, why am I fucking going to work? Why am I grafting? I could just be an idiot. And it makes you feel, a young kid feel foolish.
The reality stars, though, when you turn up at those showbiz events, the awards ceremonies, the reality stars are the ones that everyone's interested in.
Yeah.
Even the other celebrities. It's weird. You know, the table of those, Muggy Mike will turn up or someone and everyone goes, oh, there's Muggy Mike. And
some of them
so
I really
bizarre.
Like. Some of them have become friends because of Murder and Successful. Some of them I like Mark Wright is a good mate of mine, and Jamie
Lang.
He's a
nice bloke, isn't he? Yeah.
I love Mark. I think Mark's a credit to reality TV. I think he's actually surpassed it and he's moved on, and it's not been an easy transition, but he's actually sort of making good moves, and I respect that side of him massively. I just, my problem with it is it creates such a negative way of them being. I've been at award ceremonies and heard them talking to people in such a fashion where they sort of feel like they can be as rude as they like, and you sort of sit and think, you know, you're not trading out on any particular skill. Yeah. You're being yourself, and you know, obviously there's a market for that. But
they have their lives taken apart, though. I mean, they've got no privacy like you have and I have. They literally have nothing.
But then they sign that deal with
you. Yeah, they do. Yeah, they sign their soul to the devil, but then we own them, and so we can do what we want. And then they crash and burn at some stage, don't they, all of them? And then they have a horrible time.
But that's what I think the better one, the ones that you look at and go, oh, wow, you've been canny there. Yeah. You know, you've got at just the right time. To be fair to some of them, not even Gary from Geordie Shore, you think, well, actually, You've come out of it. You've now got a kid. You've got a wife. You've walked away from that world. You've earned a couple of quid. And do you know what? You're set up.
Yeah.
And he's invested it in things. I just think it's... I think it's a sad state of affairs that that's become the sort of biggest thing on television.
Well, stop watching it then.
I know.
Talking about gladiators, I was at an event, a charity event once. And it was years after Gladiators finished. And a guy, one of the gladiators, don't know what his name was, I can't think, what were their names? Wolf
Hunter,
or something.
Hunter, Wolf,
One of them turned up in their gladiator outfit, and I thought, oh Christ, you've got to know when's the time to leave the industry.
Yeah.
You know
what I mean? It's funny to think of he's got one of them, and it's made out of darning it at home. Yeah.
Turns up with his big cotton bud. Who wants to fight? The other thing I like about those award ceremonies is the celebrities who get drunk. Generally, the reality stars do that. But I always think the worst place to get drunk is in amongst all your peer group in the industry. Yeah. But every year, there's people who stagger around like that, going up to commissioning editors, telling them what they really think.
Yeah, the best bit of advice I ever had was, no matter you win, you lose, whatever, get out of Dodge. Don't be there after. Like, have the awards, have a drink, be civil, but get out. Because seriously, like, the worst thing you can be is exactly that. Drunk, walking around, shouting your mouth off. Yeah. You're either going to come across as an arrogant prick because you've just won and you're dancing about, or you're going to come across as a bitter prick because you've not.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's nothing in between.
All right, listen, we're going to talk about Murder and Successful, Action Team, Keith Lemon, all that sort of stuff a bit later on. But I thought I'd do the interview the wrong way around and say, well, what have you got coming up?
Yeah.
What are you doing soon?
It's a nice time, but it's a bit of a strange time. So we've done Action Team, and that's sort of taken the last couple of years. And then Murder was, so it's been 5 years really of sort of constant, you know, Murder to Action Team of work like that. So we're hoping the Murder and Successful film is just this thing where it's sort of burning away, and it's something that I truly hope happens, because I think we're not done with that yet. And I think that it would be great to sort of go out on a massive high. So we're sort of just, I think we're nearly there with finance for it, which would be amazing, because I think it's, when we first made that show, it felt such a unique and different thing. And obviously we're going to talk about it later. But so that is something that we're sort of persevering. And so I'm writing a thing at the moment, which is early days, but it's a more drama, sort of comedy drama, but drama type thing about the Wild West and how the American dream started, when Abraham Lincoln in like 1963 basically let a homelet thing where you could basically, anyone could basically get land. It was after the Civil War and people could apply and have land. And it was the sort of beginning of saying that anyone, no matter where you were from, could be anything they wanted. You'd be a landowner, you could have a town. And so the start of it is that. And it's a sort of, you know, it's a Western, I'm obsessed with that genre. So it's, yeah, but it's sort of probably for me and James, who I write with and who directs, it's our closest thing to a sort of drama.
How do you know about that era then? Why are you obsessed with it?
I sort of just through reading stuff and I was, me and my dad, as when I was a kid, would always watch, like, you know, Western's a Wild Bunch. I was going to be called Jeremiah, because my dad was obsessed with Jeremiah Johnson.
Who's Jeremiah Johnson?
He was played by Robert Redford. It's an amazing film.
I've seen it.
It's an incredible piece of film, where it's pretty much all just one man, and he becomes a man of the woods and a mountain man, and you know, he leaves civilization. It's just incredible. I've always loved that genre and like Larry McMurtry and stuff like that. So I was sort of, you know, how do we get into doing something like that? And fortunately, Murder and Successful was so batshit crazy and so different.
Yeah,
and Action Team was, we sort of took the writing up a level, but also the way it looked and felt. So it felt natural, really, to sort of keep on going with that high spec type idea.
The reason why I've turned the interview around is because everyone will notice you keep saying we, because you've been very clever. You're not just a gun for hire, are you? You've actually set up your own production company.
Yeah.
Who is the we, and how did you come about doing it, and why did you do it?
So the we is me, James DeFrond, and Andy Brereton. So James and me have known each other since we were mid-teens. So James basically was sort of the cleverest guy when we were growing up, and but then he sort of left after the school. He didn't go to university. He started as a runner at Talkback. And he sort of, but me and him would go out and we'd make little videos, and I was going to, you know, when I started stand up. So we've sort of over the last 15 years really been grafting away at this. You know, it's sort of that weird thing of all of a sudden you come to the public's, you know, notice, but I've been, you know, been around for quite a long time.
Overnight success.
Yeah, but it's taken me 10 years to be so.
Yeah.
So me and him were, you know, we've sort of grafted a long time to sort of get there. And then Andy Brereton was the guy I sort of developed Murder with, really. And he's an incredible producer and an incredible, like, genuinely, like, almost a genial sort of mind. So the three of us were like, you know, Murder was such a different show and it gave us a sort of USP. We were like, with Action Team, let's have some ownership. So we sort of set up Vendemol and we had a sort of goal.
So Endemol with the umbrella, are they?
Yeah,
right. And you're Shiny Button.
Yeah, we're Shiny Button.
Shiny
Button
because?
Well, the first thing I ever did was Sleep was with
Murder
Conor
Maynard.
Yeah. And I gave him a button and said, look after that shiny button. And then it became a bit of a thing where I'd give people this button and they, we never made the cut because it, but they'd just be turning around going, what am I going to do with this button? No, you'll know when to use it. So it became a bit of a joke. And so, yeah, it's hard to name it. It's like naming a kid, naming a company.
Yeah.
It was just sort of like, we went through loads of names. It was like, no, just go with this, fuck it. Mm. But yeah, so it's the three of us. And then, you know, we've got a great little team. And but the idea is to make stuff that constantly feels like high in concept, stuff that isn't your normal, and giving people who were fans of Murder, but also, yeah, we've got two girls, Kate Heron and Bryony Redmond, who are fantastic. They're really talented directors and writers, but they think about things in such a big scale. It's really, really exciting for them to sort of come to us and, you know, us develop them. So that's the other thing, is it's just making stuff that isn't the norm.
Did you own Murder and Successful as well? Was that your production company?
Yeah, well, that's with us and Tiger Aspect. Yeah,
right.
So that's a sort of co-pro now with us.
Okay.
But that was a sort of, you know, Tiger and Endemol were brilliant because they were like, look, you know, you have a clear goal of what the stuff you want to make, and we'll support you on that. And that's what this sort of this year is really, is the development of us as a. So we sort of consciously were like, let's have a year of getting stuff off the ground.
Yeah.
Let's make new stuff. Let's make new content, stuff that was, you know, because then hopefully you get to the end of this year and you might not shoot loads, you might not film loads, but you hopefully have two or three really strong projects, not all me-centric or James-centric or Andy-centric, but stuff that we've got that's moving along.
But you must look at everything in a different way because, you know, if you're just a jobbing actor or not a jobbing, you know, you're an actor or comedian and you want to get yourself in a program, you're thinking, how much money am I going to earn from this?
Yeah.
How much do I get paid? I want to get paid more. What's the maximum I can get? Whereas you're thinking, I need to put profits on screen, I imagine, because you want it to look good, because you want to get the next commission. So you must change the way you you think about your job.
Well, Action Team was massively for us. Like me, Andy and James made a conscious decision that every bit of money that we would go on screen, just because it was the first thing that we were doing that was scripted. And we had a vision, and James as a director had a vision, and we had a way that we wanted it to be. So it would have been short-sighted to go, all right, we're going to make we can get this money and that money.
Yeah.
Rather than go, right, let's put our asses on the line, and literally put our money where our mouth is. And what's been great about that is the way it looks and the way it feels is like nothing else that you've seen. And, you know, we basically went out and shot an action movie in 6 weeks. And you'd have months to shoot that. We were doing stunts.
I thought it was high budget because there was like, people dying. There's a lot of death in it.
Yeah.
And you know, there's nice special effects coming off it and stuff. And you were thinking, well, this, you know, they spent a bit of money on this. It's nice to get a big budget.
But we didn't. We you know, ITV were great. ITV, we said to ITV, this is our vision. This is how we're going to do it. And they were incredibly supportive. But the truth of the matter is that there's not as much money in television unless you've got, and we went straight to series, so it wasn't a pilot. So it was very hard to go to other people and get more money and get more investment because we didn't have a product to sell. So, but the main thing was, I think when we were making it, we wanted it to look, if we were going to undercut it and we opened with quite a big you know, a dick joke, and that's our humour. We, you know, I'm unapologetic about, you know, that's the stuff I find funny. I find the coarse and I find stupidness funny. And but if we're going to do that, it has to look high end. Because if it looks a bit naff and all of a sudden you're doing dick joke, the whole thing falls apart at the seams. Whereas if it looks high spec and it's played quite straight, so the idea and the stunts, the action always had to feel real.
Yeah, because you every interview you do, the one you do with me on Sunday Brunch, where you go, hey, you did your own stunts. I now imagine that phone call was with James, or that conversation with James. How much does stunt man? What? No, I'll do them. Yeah,
it wasn't fun. And also, you weirdly had, like, it was so hard. So this, you know.
You were on a speeding train, weren't you?
Yeah, yeah. But the weird thing was, when we first arrived in Bulgaria, because we did a lot of the stunts in Bulgaria, the guy turned up and he was like, for Tom's stunt guy, we don't have one guy who fits him, but we have a guy who has Tom's legs and we have a guy that has his upper body. Because if you look at my figure, I'm quite big up top. I'm a bit, but I have really skinny legs.
Yeah.
So they couldn't find someone who had. So there's scenes, if they were doing any shots with me, where they had to shoot the legs or the upper half or the back. And so, and then there's a film, there's a bit in the last episode where, you know, Vlad and Logan are playing both and they have a showdown. So I had to fight myself, essentially. It's an amazing thing to have done. And we did it in 2 hours. You think, like Tom Hardy, when he did it in a week.
Yeah, you must have that. You must sit down and have those conversations, though, which most actors don't have, which is this sort of how are we going to get this commissioned? How are we going to pitch it? All those things. But also, how are people going to consume this? Because we're watching it on demand, aren't we? You must be aware with Murder and Successful, people are watching. They're not watching it go out at the time. They're watching it later on.
It's a weird thing. I mean, Murder and Successful is a case in point, and and this is credit to the BBC massively, was that when we started that off, people forget that the first series, it was like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah.
It genuinely was that.
That's what I thought. I'll be
honest.
You've
actually been one of the biggest supporters of it.
I did like it, yeah.
But it really was like, so it took a real time to grow. And that's what the BBC, lucky, you know, by series two, it had grown, you know, and we'd won an award. And series three, everyone kind of, you know, people come into it. But it's a subjective thing, I think, when an action team's the same. I think you can only really make, and if you care about stuff, you can only make stuff that you want to make. So Murder and Successful, I was never like, oh God, will people like this? I'm always conscious of, as a comedian and as anyone who's making any sort of content, you have to make, and you have to be ready for not being the beige in the middle, not being the guy that people aren't going to, you know, remember. Like, they're just going to go, oh yeah, I think I remember that show. You want to be like, oh my God, that was terrible, or fucking hell, that was incredible. You want to incite some sort of reaction.
Yeah.
Because that's what we're all trying to do, right?
Yeah, whether they like it or they don't like it, you want someone to have the thought process about what you're putting on screen. And I don't think what people realise, the viewers realise, is there's so many layers to get something on screen.
Yeah.
There's so many opinions. And you know, every now and then when something amazing comes along, like your show is very different, The Young Ones when we were kids, stuff like that, you go, how the hell did that end up on TV? Who's you got to find the commissioner, the genius who went, I'm going to give that a go.
I mean, I think that, but also I think you have to, as a writer and as a, like this country, for example, now, when I sit and watch that, it's such a refreshing, brilliantly written piece. People just think that, you know, and actually, credit to BBC Three, because like a lot of people wrote that off as a channel when it went online. And Damien Kavanagh there he's commissioned some incredible stuff. You look at, you know, the budgets, the constraints that they have, that, you know, Fleabag, people just, you know, he's literally had back-to-back-to-back hits. And that is, some of that is through the fact that actually they saw the fact that we were going into a world where certainly our demographic and the people that are watching our shows are going to pick up, you know, later in the week. I remember the first series of Murder went out, and it went out on TX on TV, and you'd have like, I think it went out on 10 o'clock on a Tuesday, or whatever, and you'd see a load of tweets on that Tuesday. And then series two was out on iPlayer. And you'd have spikes where people, usually Friday, Thursday.
Careful banging that thing, because it goes straight. No, it's going straight through the mic when you're banging the table. Yeah, go on, carry on. Just for people listening.
Terrible as well. Annoying me. So we basically then sort of saw the spikes go up and down. And now, weirdly, where action teams going up on a TX on a Monday night, you see more of a spike on a Tuesday lunchtime. Then you'll see another one on Friday evening. And you go, all right, people are just consuming stuff differently.
Tuesday lunchtime?
Yeah. You have hits of people
watching TV on Tuesday lunchtime?
On their break. where people sit there and go, I'm just going to watch this.
You talk about demographics, but I worry about that when people say we're aiming at this demographic, because surely good TV is good TV.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that...
And everyone, well, you make good TV, everyone's going to watch it, no matter how old they are.
I mean, we've, weirdly, with ITV, we've brought in a lot of people who are older than would usually watch ITV too. And I think that's, again, we were never consciously going, all right, this is what this sort of people would like, or that sort of, you know.
Yeah.
Actually, when it came to the final season of Murder, the thing that I was like, is this has to now try and push into a little bit more like the mainstream, and it has to, so you have to have names that my mum is going to know, and my aunt's going to go, oh my God, you've got Lorraine Kelly doing it.
Yeah.
And that felt like the push of it to open up to that demographic. But I don't think you can ever, I think you all you can do is make stuff that's good and that you believe in. That's the skill to it.
So just indulge us, what's happening in the TV world then from your point of view? The live slots are still probably tea time. People can still tune into TV then, yeah. Don't they? They sit there and maybe Saturday evening, Sunday morning.
Sunday evenings are great. I'll tell you what, Channel 4 recently smashed it with... but they did my TV highlight of the last year has been The Big Little Railway. I thought that was just genius.
What's that? I didn't watch it.
Oh man, it was Channel 4. It was about a group of guys that built Dick Strawbridge, basically built a miniature railway from the bottom of Scotland all the way to Fort William. Yeah. And it was something that they couldn't do in the Victorian days with a real railway. And he basically did this miniature railway. And it was just a really, what it basically came down to is about relationships and people getting together to do something. But they had that, and then they went into SAS, which is another one of my favourite shows, when they were a massive contrast. But you saw people watching that. You know, people are...
But when you're going to commissioning meetings, are people just talking about on demand now? Is that for your starter stuff?
Yeah, I mean, but I think people still want to attract viewers. You still want to get people over. I think everyone knows now that, you know, I still think that when Action Team is all out on the ITV Hub, there'll be a whole other life for it, because it will sit there.
Because I want to binge. Sit.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to binge.
Yeah, I do, though. My viewing taste is now to sit. I've just watched the Looming Tower. And you sit there.
What's
and,
that?
It's about 9/11, about CIA and CIA and the FBI. The argument that
is it they drama?
Did. Yeah, it's incredible. Oh man, it's amazing.
Where's that on?
Amazon with Jeff Daniels.
Right,
it's a brilliant piece of work. But I sat with my wife and you watch it in an afternoon.
Yeah, see, yeah. I just hammered series 3 of Gomorrah, and then I'm doing Love, and that's how I like doing. I like to come in and then every night do it. So that's
it's like Save Me. I've got Save Me now.
Yeah,
ready to start watching this weekend.
So was there ever a thought process that you put all of Action Team out on the same day, all of them?
No, not really. I think it was more that you want to stagger that. I think that's going to come soon enough. I think that will have to happen where people are just putting everything out and all the content's there. But I think we wanted to try and sort of get it out. It's,
yeah, because yours has an arc in it, right?
Yeah, massively.
Because of that, you want to binge.
Yeah, and I think that's what will happen. I think, you know, and that we live in a world now where the sell on is, you know. Where does it live next? Where does it go to ITV? Because, you know, so many people are coming to British comedy now through Amazon or through, you know, Fleabag and Catastrophe were incredible on Amazon. So it's like, where do you go next? Where's the thing? Because it sort of, it sits well on with that arc to sit on a streaming service as well. So it's, yeah.
So how's that Action Team doing for you?
It's good. It's been a critically acclaimed show. It's, like I said, it's getting people watching it on the ITV Hub. It's not probably getting as many people watching it when it goes out as you sort of think. But I'm proud of it. I think...
Do you know what I love about it? I said this to you before. It's the work experience guy.
Oh, just yeah,
that,
amazing.
But it's just that element which made me really laugh. The fact that he's looking at you all the time. You guys going, what the hell are you doing? And it's really nice to see it from a viewer's... You know, like he's kind of like a viewer, isn't he?
Yeah.
It actually written into the thing.
Well, you kind of always want to have that sort of... Weirdly, with Murder and Successful, it was the person who comes into the show. It was the guest.
Yeah.
Was the audience's link in. And with this, it's been Coyote, who is like... He's another level talented, that guy. He really is. I think he'll go as far as he wants to in a business. Because even when he's not got any dialogue or what, he's just in it all the time. His reactions. And if you just watch, I can just sit and watch him just in the background of a shot. And he's just mystical. Amazing.
What is the writing process like? Do you plot it all out first and write in the gags? Do you start with the gags? Which way does it work?
We started writing it as a drama. So we thought, right, well, actually... really, firstly, we started trying to write it as a comedy, and it just was impossible to write like that. So we thought, right, let's write it as a drama. Because our thing was, we wanted to make something that felt like it could be like a box set, that it could just go from episode to episode. You had cliffhanger moments. That's how this is shows that me and James watch. So when we were writing it, so we basically went back to the drawing board, and we just started again, and we wrote it as a sort of arc, almost like a film. Like Spielberg, in a sense, says every 10 minutes you have to have that cliffhanger moment. So if you watch a Spielberg film,
there'll always be
a moment of romance or something. So and that's how every film that he's sort of done, Indiana Jones is a perfect template for that. So what we were trying to do is go, right, well, it actually works really well for us because we have 10 minutes and you have a break and then you have another 10 minutes and then you're out, sort of almost. So we basically knocked it down to that. And then we added, undercut it. That's what Murder Successful was. And the tone of humour that we find funny is...
Sorry, what does undercut it mean?
So you'd have a moment like the dick joke at the top, or where you everything's really high. It's basically coming in at a height of drama, and then his dick's hanging out, and that's where you're undercutting a joke, or a computer, you're doing something, it's high end and a phone breaks. It's always just finding that silliness. And, I assume everyone knows that, but it's just me and James, we talk in that language. And that's the tone of the Murder and Successful thing was what we always wanted, and we enjoy, is playing this ridiculousness, but playing it straight. Like with Sleet, I never looked at playing him to be funny. I always thought it's going to be funnier if I'm trying to make him like Denzel Washington rather than if I'm doing big jokes. And so the more dramatic he is, the more pathetic he is. So I think with Action Team, it's sort of carrying that on, and that's why Vicky and Stephen
and you got yourself ready for the role, didn't you? You actually bothered to lose weight and everything. And you lost a lot, didn't you? How much did you lose?
4 stone. Yeah. But I put on
my... That's Hollywood stuff, that is.
Yeah, but then you see, weirdly, it's changed. Like, I didn't want to go down that route of putting up pictures because I think it's a bit worthy and it's a bit wanky. But like genuinely, like without my top off, and I've put a bit of a gut back on, but it's changed. Like the guy who I did, who my personal trainer, who was this amazing Russian guy, he wasn't actually Russian, that's just me being really bored. He was from, I can't remember where he's from now, Lithuania, something like that. It's terrible. You just look at my shoulders, you're like, wow, it's changed my whole body shape through doing that and through working out. So I was working out like 5 or 6 times a week. I was doing like Wing Chun, Krav Maga, Thai boxing. So I was doing stuff all the time. And it was literally that, because when I first knew you, when I first did Sunday Brunch, I was sort of, drinking and eating that crap. To actually then go out and go, right, actually, I've changed my whole lifestyle now. So I'm not going to go out and drink. And that's stayed on with me, really.
So did you do fighting stuff prior to trying to lose weight?
Not really. I'd done bits of boxing. I'd done little bits and bobs. Not really. That was like a real, like the Wing Chun, and like when you're 6'7" trying to do
Wing Chun? Is that Kung Fu?
Kind of, yeah. It's like a sort of, it's a lot of speedy movements and banging taps hands away. But yeah, it's pretty amazing.
Are you any good? Are you a contender?
No. Krav Maga was pretty... Krav Maga's incredible.
Right, that's the Israeli... So isn't that supposed to be the hardest martial art or something?
Yeah, but it's also just using for sort of people's weight against them, but also sort of it's quite brutal and quick. It's really fun. I loved it. I literally was like, wow. Like, to think... Because I was so conscious of going, right, if I'm Sleet, you believe that I'm Sleet, because I trained for 30 years to be overweight and like a sack of shit cop. Yeah. But weirdly, if you're going to buy that I'm a special agent, I can't look like Sleet. I can't, I can't be rocking around with a gut hanging out the bottom of my shirt, because it's not what the joke is. The joke was to play him high status, and it's funnier when he drops down then, and it's funny when stuff goes wrong for him.
Yeah.
Whereas Sleet is constantly pathetic. He's constantly, he knows his place in the world. So it was conscious of me to go, right, these characters need to look different. And also, if I'm then playing the Russian bad guy, I have to make him look different enough body-wise to the good guy. So to walk with a bit of a stoop. And it's easier to put in some padding and make me look fatter as that guy. But otherwise, I just look literally going to look the same.
I've never asked this question before in an interview, but I'm going to ask it because what you just said. Did you get in a lot of fights when you were younger?
Not really, no. No, I was more scared of stuff. I was picked on a bit. I was like...
I don't want to talk about your height, but I'm going to do it. Because you're the big guy, do people want to come
and it's, chances? It still happens now and again. I was like, the awful thing when I was in this, like walking through a festival and I was with a girl that I was seeing at a time, and a guy threw a can at me, and then he took his top off and flexed, and he just wanted to fight. And I was like, you're insane. And there was a crowd of people. So, yeah, it sort of happened more really that people, you know, and still now and again you see it, people get aggressive. I've been at West Ham, actually, with a guy who was just couldn't. He was so like the aggressor. And
did he recognize you?
I'm not sure if it was that, or he was just, I think, because I was chatting to people and I'm quite an affable guy, and I think it's something, just, you know, whether he just had a horrible life at home.
Yeah,
he made it.
See, I think me and alcohol don't mix, as in when I'm out, it's, if most people I meet are just so lovely,
yeah,
and then sometimes you put me in a football scenario especially, or yeah, something like that, and then alcohol, then someone will come up and maybe be aggressive to me.
It's a terrifying thing, because alcohol is just...
just gives them that little edge,
yeah,
to do
and
something.
It's a scary thing when you can see someone change completely. And you know, I've got friends who have been affected by alcoholism, and I sort of, I think through my 20s, I wrestled, until I became creative with doing stand-up and stuff, and that became a way of, like, sort of cathartically trying to do something different. I drank a lot because I was dealing with, you know, like a lot of men, I'd worked on building sites for a long time, so I didn't necessarily ever talk about stuff that I had in my head or worries that I had. I'd drink and I'd be loud and I'd have a joke. But actually it wasn't until I was creative, and then weirdly I saw like the Professor Green documentary, and actually that movement of that Calm have done, it's a really important thing that, as guys, you are chatting now about your feelings. You know, in sort of late 90s, and you know, me and you have talked about almost that before, lad culture was such a big thing that you wouldn't have just turned around and gone, oh, I feel like shit today, I just feel like not getting out of bed and crying, because it just wasn't, it's sort of a said thing now, but then it wasn't. So you were, you know, and actually it's easy, really easy, to no matter what's going on in your life, you know, you split up in your relationship, blah, 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 whatever's going on, to go out, have a beer, have another beer, and just put a face on.
Yeah.
And that's what I'd realised that I've been doing for almost 15 years.
Yeah, and eventually it breaks.
Yeah.
You break. And I mean, I talked about Alistair Campbell about this a lot on my podcast I did with him. Yeah, I've been through really dark moments in my life, but exactly that. One day, if you go into dark moments, you've got to wake up and go, hold on, what am I doing?
And then, and it's really, my wife has been really great for that, but it's that weird thing of being... I think even before I did this for a living, if I was on a building site, I wasn't the best scaffolder. I was a good, you know, but what I was great at is having a laugh, and I was being one of the lads. So you sort of had that mask. Sometimes it would be like, God, you know, having to put it on.
Yeah.
And weirdly, the easiest thing, the best thing, was to all of a sudden you're making stand up, and although you're bearing your soul in front of a room full of people you don't know, it's you're being you, and you're talking about stuff that you'd never have spoken about before, that's been on your mind, and you know, you realize that everyone thinks these things, but I could probably count on my hand, like in the time I worked in, you know, one hand, where you'd have an actual conversation with someone that would mean something more than I banged her, or I did this, or I fucking fought him. Most of the time it was just fucking front. And there was nothing behind. And actually you go, oh, actually, no, that's
kind of what men do, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think that's where our security is, and our safety blanket is in not showing emotion.
But you realise you respect someone so much more if you break all down that persona. And it went weirdly, what stand-up did, and when I first started stand-up, is the best stand-ups are people that I was really like someone like Mickey Flanagan on the outset is probably one of the best joke writers in the world. I mean, he's incredible. But actually, if you break Mickey Flanagan down, he is actually talking about stuff. And as a working class man, he's talking about your failures, your dreams, your hopes, things that don't necessarily ever come true. And I think you'd be backstage with people. And for me, it was like, wow, I was never going to be the funniest person in that room. I was always like looking at people thinking, how do you break something down? How do you?
I've been through a couple of serious bouts of depression and like really debilitating type stuff. And I found that some of my mates just couldn't handle it.
Yeah.
So you couldn't talk to them about it. And then the classic, well, you've got to be depressed about, or pull your socks up, or come, just get out on it. Just get,
yeah.
Come on, let's just go out. We'll go clubbing, or we'll go and watch a band, we'll go to football, you know, just do it. That'll kick you in your life.
People can't fathom it.
Don't work. Yeah.
I had it when I first, weirdly. So I was very fortunate. I sort of came into this game. I'd done stand up. I did a bit of radio, and I did the Morgana show, and I did a pilot for Channel 4. And it was like, wow, this is really going well. And then for like a year, nothing happened. I couldn't get an audition. I couldn't buy a job. I was like, you know, I'd gone from like, wow, flying in and you know, to literally nothing. For a year, it was like, and I'd had no training, so I had no background in this game. So I sort of had been really fortunate to crack on. And I found myself there. That was probably the time where I look at it and go, oh, I was really depressed. I was really down because I'd gone from a place where like I knew my 9 to 5, I knew my week, I knew everything had been on a schedule, and all of a sudden there wasn't a schedule, there wasn't anything. And actually, so what the most important thing for me to do was find, like now with my wife, what you realise is our lives are like a helter-skelter. They're like a roller coaster. Sometimes you're up, sometimes you're down, sometimes you're going round and round and fucking, you know.
Yeah.
But what you need to do is find something that's more important than the job and that roller coaster. So with my wife, it was the thing of finding someone who's a rock, something you'd like literally, no matter where I was in my life, whether I was up or down, I'm coming back and I've got someone who, that's not their importance. Their importance is me and my health. And I think that's the most important thing for me when you break down this game.
Well, you talk about going into this industry. You got in through quite a strange way, didn't you? You said you and James were making and then he was working with Keith Lemon. Is that
so?
Right?
Yeah, he was a producer on. He'd done Bo Selector.
Yeah.
So when I first knew Lee, he was sort of, I think he'd just finished Bo Selector.
So let's just go back. You left school. You end up on the building sites and the market trader. And
I did chefing for a bit.
Chefing. Also,
a little bit.
But were you, in the back of your head, were you always thinking, I'm a star? No. I should be on the big screen.
I never thought it would get to this level, this far.
Yeah.
And I just, I think it was just, waking up one day thinking, fucking hell, it can't be just this. I'll tell you actually what it was. There's a book called Billy, and it's written by Billy Connolly's wife.
Right.
And it's actually looking to, like her as a psychiatrist looking at Billy Connolly. And there's a passage in the book, and I've talked about this quite a lot, but where Billy Connolly says he's on in the shipyards, and he's learning to play the banjo, and he's thinking about going professional. And he turns to an old guy, and he says, oh, you know, next year, I think I might go professional. And the old guy says, oh, you'll never do it, because next year will come the year after and the year after and the year after. And you need to know that there's nothing worse than being an old man sitting in a place like this, realizing that what could have been. And I sort of therefore, I'd go to loads of comedy clubs and watch people and think, oh, fuck, I'd get out there for 5 minutes and do that. That can't be that hard. Even if it never goes anywhere else, apart from just standing up there and at the end of a week going, I've worked 5 days a week on the scaffolder, I'm just going to go and try that. And even if it was just enough just to get up there and have something a bit different from the norm. And I was fortunate, and it, you know, through the luck of the gods. But yeah, we showed Lee something, and he was great, man. He was like, you know,
I've never met Lee. I've only ever met Keith Lemon. Yeah. And it's famously known, Keith Lemon stays in character as Keith Lemon. So I have no idea what Lee Francis is like.
I mean, this is the thing, because for me, he's sort of like, James is without a doubt the most important person in my career. James has done everything with him, and we gave up our weekends and lives that we do now. But Lee Francis is incredible as a mentor. I learned so much how to conduct yourself on set, how to, you know, with your clear vision to make stuff that you believe in. You know, you look at Bo Selector and how crazy that seemed at the time. So Lee, and as a friend, he's just always there. He's always at the end of her phone. He's a really good man.
As I say, I've never met him. I've only met Keith. And Keith, when he first came on Sunday Brunch, I was so worried about it because, you know, he's so wild. And I'd been on Celebrity Juice, and guys, vulgar. And I thought, you know, as a presenter, I don't care what he says, but I've got to protect the show. So, you know, you've got to always apologise when people have overstepped the mark. And I was thinking, I've got my work cut out today. And he was just absolutely brilliant. He's such a pro. He knew exactly how to aim it.
Yeah.
He was funny. He was charismatic. We couldn't wait to get him back on screen, basically. Every time we were putting him in more items. He brought the studio alive. He's fantastic.
He is incredible to watch. And I think probably the most underrated, genuine actual comedy writer and performer, because you see stuff. I don't know. The first thing I sort of got note for was a thing called Shimon Selector, which was him doing, after Michael Jackson died, he did the death of that Bo Selector character. And some of the stuff he does in that is just like, if you think, if you were, I don't think he ever got the acclaim for that, that particular piece. Go back and watch it. It's mesmerizing. He's just incredible.
So how long was it when you started doing stuff? Because you obviously, when you first arrive, you probably think, I'm a bit of a chancer here. I'm a bloke off the scaffoldings, you know.
Yeah,
And I'm standing here in show business land. How long did it take you before you felt part of it?
I think Murder and Successful. I think it was 10 years. It was a
really?
Long time,
all that time?
I think because... I think people have a perception of you that they think is, Murder and Successful, because of how it is and the uniqueness and the difference, it was the thing that weirdly felt like people going, oh, right, he's not just... Even people who'd never met me or the scaffolder thing is 10 years ago and it's still... It'll always be talked about, and I talked about to Paul Whitehouse about this because it is... There's not many of us who go... come into this game and are from that background. There's just not.
Yeah, who have proper jobs first.
Yeah
I've had a lot
also,
of proper jobs.
When your proper job is being on a building site,
right.
It's a weird thing of
going... Mine wasn't quite that. Mine was clothes shops, but there you go.
but it's a similar thing. There's not a lot of us.
Didn't get my hands dirty, though.
calluses. So I think people had forged an opinion of me before, or they did sometimes meet me. So I think Murder and Success was the first time that I felt really like, oh, wow. Like, and that's not everyone. I just think genuinely, I felt like across the board, people have now gone, oh, right, he's good.
How cool is that, though? I was talking to Paul Whitehouse about it. Yeah, Michael Caine's told me so many times, don't name drop. That's what he said. No, Paul Whitehouse, though, he's such an amazing guy, isn't he? It's so amazing that you now hang out with all these people after coming from that background where you thought, I'm going
to
be...
But weirdly, though, the people that I've become really good friends with tend to be... from similar backgrounds, from similar...
Right.
The people within, like yourself, like I get on with, I chat to you, but you're a similar guy from a similar background. People just know those guys are good friends of mine. Romesh, actually, is one of my really good friends.
Funny guy, yeah.
But Romesh, the great thing about Rom is Rom was a teacher for years, so we sort of know the outs, sort of
I
that
I think
side
it's
of
important to make it, to do that proper work first.
Yeah.
I think it's really important.
Because also you...
It makes you really appreciate what...
I agree, and that's the thing, and it sounds corny, and you sort of... I appreciate it. I'm humbled every morning I wake up. To do this for a living is genuinely like, it's like you've rolled a double six every day. It's like your hand of cards is amazing. You literally go through life going, that's my job is essentially to dick about with my mates.
Yeah.
And I was at school and I was sort of the kid from, I remember being pulled up in front of the class by a teacher and going, out of Tom Davis and Christine Bellwood, who do you think is going to get further out of life? Who's going to do better? To the rest of the class,
and everyone
went, Christine.
Yeah.
And I don't know what she does now. I'm not afraid. But sort of, so life had given up. And this is weirdly a thing that I started doing quite a lot of work with a charity called Interfilm, which works with kids from bad backgrounds and whatever to try and get them into making stuff. Because the worst thing you can do is for a kid is take away like hope and dreams. Because even if those dreams aren't fulfilled, like the truth is to take it away and go, like ridicule a kid. Because he goes, I want to be a comedian. I remember going down the job centre and they said, what do you want to do? I said, I want to be an actor and a comedian. I said, that's not realistic. What is it now you want to do? I said, I'll be an astronaut.
Yeah, the thing changed for me was when I started telling everyone, yeah, I'm going to be a TV presenter, and everyone just laughed at me. And then this guy called Chris years later came up and said, do you know how much shit you got behind your back because you said you wanted to be a TV presenter? But it was the only way I could do it. I had to actually tell people I was going to do it. I knew I was going to get grief, but otherwise I was never going to do it. I was going to be the guy who never, you know, who never had the balls to do it. You've got to at one stage start telling people that's what you're going to do, and then believe it and go for it.
And in the end, and also when you come from a background such as that,
you
have that weird thing of, and I still really worry about it happening one day, is that thing of going, no matter what you've won, what you've done, where you've been, that one day you've got to walk back in that pub and they go, ah, you fucked that, didn't you? I told you it wasn't going to work.
All right, Murder and Successful. We got viewers from all over the world listening to this, or listeners on the podcast. Tell us what it is. How do you describe it if they didn't know? We've talked about it a lot. But
so it's a murder mystery with a celebrity guest who comes in, and it's impressionists playing the people who make up the town. So Simon Cowell would be the mayor, Alan and Jimmy Carr are like the Cray brothers. And there's been a murder, and I, as a character DIC, I help them solve that murder. It's a weird thing. Whenever we pitched it, even now, and this is 3 years of making that show, I really don't know how to sum it up at times. And it's sort of almost like, but then people watch it and go, oh, I get it.
Have you sold it into America yet?
Yeah, I mean, we were chatting about it. There's sort of two places that have really made a real sort of bid for it. But that, again, so this is a business thing. Make the film and then go, right, well, in America, we have more license if the film's a success or even if it's, you know, a cult hit. But if you really want to do it, do you want to sell it or do you want to go over to America with your production company, with how we make it, and you sell it to America with us all in it, or you sell it to Netflix?
Phone up Ricky Gervais, ask what he did.
Well, he's like,
does that work for him? Whatever he did, it worked for him. Well, he's the Office. Like,
he's the guy, though, isn't he? He's so incredible. His new stand up's just.
I haven't seen it yet. Is it good?
Yeah, I love him.
On Netflix,
you know,
right?
Yeah, and you know what? He I think Ricky's weirdly, you know, when you look at Ricky as a guy who comes from a similar background, actually. What I love about him is he's out there and he's going toe-to-toe with anyone.
Yeah.
And there's something so unapologetic about that. And it's something that is, you look for in this industry, you constantly have to look for inspirations and people that you look at and go, right, you know, he can do that. I could do that. And I think like Ricky's one of those people where I look at him and I think, you know, he sort of gets, you know, he's just an incredible, like, massive inspiration for me.
Well, are there any other comics coming up at the moment that you think we should be keeping an eye out for?
It's that weird thing of people. There's a show going to be that's called Staff, which is Staff Sells Houses with Jamie Dimitri from this. People who know comedy know Jamie, and I think he's just like he's just. We had him on. He played Zayn Malik in Murder and Successful, and he's just. I can't even put it genuinely. It's seldom that you see someone who blows you away like Jamie does. He's just an amazing performer. He's so nuanced in everything he does. But then his sister, Natasha Dimitri, and her friend, Ellie White, we're working with them on a thing at the moment. And they're just, there's a whole little scene. Liam Williams is a phenomenal writer. There's a little gaggle of those guys that you sort of look at and they're just, they do stuff that's not the norm, that is just, brilliant, and that they're understanding a character comedy, which is sometimes can be sort of, you know, not necessarily sort of like viewed in the same sort of way that say stand up or something, but their way that they can portray and make someone come real and vulnerable and loved about is just
Murder and Successful is all about you, isn't it? Because you can only write so much of the script and so much of, because you've got ad lib around what the celebrities are doing, yeah. And they're funny. They make me laugh. Deborah Meaden was great. Richard Osman was priceless. He just corrected you on absolute.
Yeah, I mean, he was weirdly. He just worked because my use of long words, even in real life, is you know, like he was. I mean, Richard's actually again someone because he works at Endemol and he's someone I, you know, count as a friend, and he's again just because he's a producer as well, right?
Yeah, we had him on this podcast. Yeah. He taught me more about the TV than I knew.
He's a phenomenon.
You know, he's
he just understands it.
And, he does, yeah.
So yeah, I mean, but I tell you, the show is made up of. I think a lot of people think that it's just thrown together and we just turn up and we do the crazy.
Yeah.
But actually, the truth of it is there's so much thought that goes into it. On the run up to it, you're working your ass off with the, you know, Luke Kempner will come in, he's playing Tom Daly, and his horse has been killed, so we're going on with Chris Kamara. So you play this whole thing I'm surrounded by Andy as a producer, Avril as a producer, James DeFron, so you're all surrounded by an amazing group of people that know how it works. But when you're face down with it, it sort of, in the end, it is, right, it's just you and Cammy, and what's Cammy going
to
say?
And how much footage do you need to create the what's the end time of the film?
They come in about 2.5 hours, maybe 2 hours.
And then you cut it down to what? What's the final?
Half hour. 30
exactly
minutes.
30 minutes.
Yeah. And that's Jasper James's works magic. And we have Callum, who's an incredible editor, and he's done everything we've ever done. So those guys, but James is, you know,
so good.
I always think I'm up front doing that sort of, you know, all that sort of stuff. Or I guess I'm in midfield doing it, and James is the finished article.
What I love about it is when they go Zayn Malik, and then someone comes on, you immediately think it is. It's amazing how that works.
But that's down to the quality of the guys who come in. This country, you forget how we're blessed and through years, but
their impressions are not. Accurate. No, you just immediately start talking to him as though he's Zayn Malik. We just go, yeah, it's that.
But we never wanted it to be seen as a sort of like an impression show. We always wanted it. Some of them are like, you know, Luke Kempner is incredible. He does an amazing, yeah. And then when White House came in and did Len Goodman, you believed that he was Len Goodman, but it wasn't like a bang on impression. Oh, it's brilliant. Just Paul.
Yeah,
Paul is just
that's
a,
it.
I mean, that is,
yeah,
that was of everything I've done. That was up there with the most surreal things. I've grown up Far Show and
oh,
was everything when I was growing up.
When I worked on The Big Breakfast, my favourite ever, I was a producer there, but I think I was a researcher at the time. I can't remember now, but Paul Whitehouse was on the show. And watching him live on Breakfast TV for 2 hours was just immense. I just couldn't take my eyes off how amazing he was. Animated, thinking, looking. He's analysing it all, and then the line comes out and he's funny. He's funny man.
When I've watched that scene back, I think it's the most I've corpsed. And it was like, wow. I'd say it felt a little bit like, you know, when you see a boxer and they get in a ring with someone and they're young. And it's a bit like, you know, Joshua, when he got in a ring with Klitschko, and Klitschko still had a few tricks. Yeah. And you really got to be at the top of your game.
He just kept switching voices and characters and stuff, though. I think it was Checkers on the show I did. And he just kept going into sort of checkers. It was really funny. You know, he did the DJ stuff.
Smashing Nicely.
Yeah, Smashing. He kept on going into that. And that was just really funny.
They were all great, those guys.
All right, I'm conscious of time. We had Harriet Harman on here and she had to leave because she had to go to Prime Minister's Question Time. Alistair Campbell had to go to discuss Brexit. You got to go. She's got to go to the dentist. I mean, for God's sake. We're being upstaged by a dental practice.
Turning out of the dentist with a bottle of fine red wine.
So we got questions. You'll have to come back and we'll get more stuck into it. But look, I've got questions we ask all the guests which come on, so we'll do this with you. What one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
I was going to say the Billy Connolly thing, to go with your dreams and chase it down, because it is people's fear of failure is the worst. That's always for me is like, oh God, I'd love to do what you do, but I just worry about it not going right. And you think, well, no, the point is just jumping and just going, right, I don't know how this is going to end up, but I don't want 40 years of what I'm living right now.
Yeah, that's true. But I always say the recipe is you've got to follow your dreams, but you've also got to work out what you're good at and work out what you're bad at, because there's no point in going, I want to play for Milan.
Yeah.
And then,
or everyone's just going to be that guy who turns up the X Factor.
Yeah.
Going,
yeah,
I can sing. And you're like, someone should have told you can't.
Yeah, but work out what you're good at and then go for it. And that's it.
But also it's...
Bizarrely, I'm not sure I'm good at this. I just turned up and did it. And
no, but I think weirdly with stand-up gig. It's like snooker or darts. You can get good at it after time. There's people... I sit and watch, and I've seen them go from there to literally straight.
Are you going back to stand up?
Yeah. I've started a few gigs. And
how are they going?
It's terrifying. It's so scary. Because also going back to it without, because my life, I gave up stand up like 6 years ago.
Yeah.
And in that 6 years, I got married. My life has changed. Six years ago, I was a very different person. So all of my material has changed. All the stuff that I find funny in my life. And you have to be truthful, I think, in stand up. You embellish stuff. You know, a bit of advice I was given when I was working on Scaffold was, you know, you're from South London, you've got a God-given right of bullshit. So you have to find out, you know, your stories, your life is different.
That's that. When we edit this one day with all the people, what's the best bit of advice you give to our listeners? Suggs's was one of my favourites. It's doesn't matter how many pints you've had when you leave the pub. Before you leave the pub, go to the toilet.
Yeah.
And yours is, if you come from South London, you've got the God-given right to bullshit. that's the one we're going to edit in. Right, what mistake do people make? It could be maybe doing your job or anything else. What's a glowing error you can see?
I think people worry too much about what other people are doing. I think you see it all the time, and you see people stutter in every part of life, where if you're running a race, like a horse, run it with blinkers on. Don't worry about who's left and who's right and how fast they're going. Just worry about you getting to the end of the finish line and you running a good race.
Great advice.
It's a mistake that you see people constantly do, especially in this game.
Stop living everybody else's lives and live your own.
Stop worrying about it.
Yeah.
Don't worry about whether Mick's got a Ferrari. It's not.
Me, it was always, I've got to be honest, for me, it was always, I can't believe he got the job and I didn't. Yeah. I can't believe it was always. And I've had a pretty decent career, 21 years or something on screen. Yeah. So it's
But worry about you and worry about how you're going. Yeah. You don't worry about writing on Facebook about slagging someone off because they've got a better chance. Or just go and write a joke, go and write 10 jokes.
I discuss this with Mark often. It's like, if you're about to go onto Twitter and slag someone off, think, is this really what my life's come to? Haven't I got something better I can do with my life? Don't worry about it. Stop living their life and worry about their life. Worry about your own.
As soon as you can get over that, and we all suffer from it, just go and I wish I'd known that.
Yeah, make you happier. Ago. Yeah. Any life hacks?
You know what is... I don't know. It's a weird one, life hacks. I was looking at this thinking about cooking.
Yeah, do it.
But it,
do a cooking one or an eating one.
Is, I don't know. I think just not drinking weird is my biggest life hack. I was like thinking about all this really spiritual, deep things to talk about you, to you. And then I was just like, the biggest thing that's made my life better is not getting pissed and not going out and not thinking that and worrying that if I didn't drink I'd lose friends and I'd lose any kind of social interaction. Worrying that like, oh, if I'm not going down the pub with the lads for like 10 pints, am I ever going to see them again? Or am I going to go to football if I'm not drinking? And actually no one gives a shit. I think
a few do.
Yeah, but then why are your mates with them? I think that's the thing. It's like, if people have got a problem with something you're doing to further your life, to make you better, do you need them in yours?
That idiot who turns up and you're there and you're not drinking yet, he buys a round and puts a pint on and goes, get that inside you. Like, I'm not drinking. No, come on. They're the idiots. Yeah.
So life hacks is, that's probably it.
Have control over your drinking habits. Any books you recommend?
I'll tell you, I've just read Harry Finlay's book, The Dog. It's incredible.
Harry the Dog, is that
but it's about a guy who was, he was a horse trainer and dog trainer, and he did this amazing sort of a scam where he basically got a load of guys on mopeds and motorbikes to go and hit a load of bookies at the same time with this massive bet, and people wouldn't take the bet off him. So he basically ran it like a military mission to make this, and he made like, I think it was like 8 million, I can't remember exactly the... But it's an incredible book. And actually, so he's a guy who was a sort of chancer, a bit of a gambler, but now used that money to set up
schools. I made his name up, Harry the Dog, or was that what...
No, it's Harry the Dog Finlay, yeah. And he went...
And was he a Millwall fan? Have I made that up?
No, I don't know if he was. No. I can't remember if he was.
I think that might be a football hooligan.
But it's not that guy. but then he went out and he invested the money in like schools in Africa and India and hospitals. So he actually went and did all his amazing charitable
and
stuff.
And are you reading that thinking... rights to this, I've got to buy the rights to this.
Yeah, I read everything like that. I've just read a book called Wiggers with Attitude about a kid from Leeds, Derby in Leeds, Andrew Emery, who wanted to be the sort of hip-hop star. And it's all about him trying but failing constantly to do it. And it's a bit like Fever Pitch as a book. So we've just got the rights for that.
Oh, brilliant. Show. How long are you going to keep the rights for?
I don't know how long it is. What are you thinking about waiting to?
Because like, people go, I bought the rights. You go, how long for? It's like a year. Then you've got to get the commission through and you've got to get all the people who, the
he,
money,
he's
you've
a
got everything.
Good guy.
All
right. Okay.
What is the meaning of life?
Happiness, right? I think it's to strive to be happy. You can spend so much time, I think, feeling down and walking about. It's back going back to what I talked about, like worrying about sweating the small stuff. I'm guilty of it. I worry too much about stuff, and I can sometimes go for a day where all I've done is stressed, and actually I'll get home and take my dog for a walk and I'll smile. I just think that's, you strive to spend your time with people and doing things that you're going to get that little, because that's not going to happen all the time. You'd be ridiculous if you walk around your whole life with a big smile on your face, you'd be sectioned. But you need to just try and find your happiness where you can get it.
And the final question, I've just added this one recently, is there an afterlife? Just a small question.
Yeah, fucking hell, Jesus, wait, finish the
Jesus,
show.
Well, if you believe in Jesus, then there is.
Yeah, I'd like to think there is. I'd like to think that you could sit and have a ruby with all the people that you've sort of touched your life and go, God, you fucked that up, didn't you?
Listen, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. If people want to follow you, what's your Twitter handle?
I'm Big Tom D on Twitter and Mr. Big Tom D. You got it wrong the other day. You tagged a picture of me and you put my name in wrong.
Oh, did I? I'm so stupid.
I've literally grown up with you, watching you. It was one of my proudest moments, and you put it wrong.
Sorry about that, mate. That's right. Tell everyone where they can watch your shows. Murder and Successful, is that still available?
Murder and Successful is still available. I think series 3 on iPlayer, and Action Team is on the ITV Hub, and it goes out Mondays, 10 o'clock.
Both worth watching, both brilliant. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be back soon on this podcast. By the way, if you want to contact us, I'm on my Twitter at Tim Lovejoy. You can email me dearlovejoypodcast@gmail.com. Subscribe to us, rate us. Hope you enjoyed it if you watched it live on Twitter. Did it work? Well, yes, it worked.
Wow. Oh, wow. And I didn't swear.
Yeah, yeah, no, you did. Stop swearing. I got text from my mom going, tell the bloke to stop swearing.
That job?
Brilliant. We'll see you all soon. Thanks. Cheers, Tom.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at lower.com field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at columbuscrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.